listening to CMDA Matters, the weekly podcast of Christian Medical and Dental Associations. Here's your host, Dr. Mike Chubb.
Welcome back to CMDA Matters, and it is the heart of winter when we get to see a lot of snow capping on the Appalachian Mountains here in Bristol. It's a bit nippy outside, and it sure does remind me of my old stomping grounds during several years of surgical practice in Southwest Michigan. That was back in the early 90s, and it was so important to have a four-wheel drive vehicle during nights on surgical call in the middle of the month of January. What a contrast to the conditions in Southern California right now, especially in Los Angeles, which is on fire. A friend of mine who lives near Yosemite Park shared with me a phone app last summer when we were on vacation there, an app that is used by Californians to get real-time data on the fires, and it's called Watch Duty. And so Pam and I have been following the three main fires on the north side of LA, in particular the Eaton Fire, because we have a niece who lives in Burbank. There has been so much loss and grief and suffering right now from these fires, which actually are still mostly not contained as of this recording. That huge, highly populated, and influential western state of our great country, the great state of California, has been at the center of so much controversy over many decades, whether political or environmental or healthcare policies and practices. I'm bringing this up right now because our guest today is a practicing endocrinologist not far from the capital of California, Sacramento. And he was asked to review a children's book that was being used in local schools, which introduced five-year-olds to the concept of what it means to be a transgender boy or girl. Well, for this interview, I asked my regular co-host, Dr. Jeff Barrows, to join me because this topic crosses over into his realm of responsibility with advocacy here at CMDA. I know that this is a topic of greatest concern for you, our listeners. Yesterday, I actually looked at the data on our 20 most listened to episodes in 2024, and the top three were all related to the gender revolution detour in healthcare and our society. Today, we're joined by Dr. Michael Laidlaw to talk about his involvement as an expert witness for sensible legislation to stop the use of harmful hormones and puberty blockers, as well as surgeries provided to minors for the purpose of gender transition. You know, this is going to be a longer interview for us, but it is loaded with really powerful evidence-based material that I think you listeners need to hear. So we've broken it down into two parts. Keep listening, and you're going to hear part one of our conversation with Dr. Michael Laidlaw. And after the interview today, I'm going to be giving you some great feedback on the final results of our end of 2024 Christmas match and giving campaign. Well, today on CMDA Matters, I'm here in the studio with Dr. Jeff Barrows, our Senior Vice President of Bioethics and Advocacy. And Jeff, there's been a topic that has really risen to the top as a case went to the Supreme Court. Just briefly review what that case was.
Well, it involves our state of Tennessee here. Mm-hmm. And Tennessee, along with I think it's now 26 other states, have banned gender transition therapies in minors. Mm-hmm. And lo and behold, there were people, including the ACLU and the current Justice Department of the Biden administration, that are unhappy about that. And mm-hmm. so they have filed suit, and it was heard by the Supreme Court. Interesting to hear and listen to the actual arguments made before the justices. Lasted about 2.5 hours. But a lot of strong feelings about this issue.
Well, our guest today actually was one of the original expert witnesses for this Scrimeti case. Dr. Michael Laidlaw is a board-certified endocrinologist and has been in private practice in Rockland, California since 2006. And in 2017, Dr. Laidlaw became quite concerned about a strong push to incorporate transgender ideas into the local school system. And kindergartners were supposed to read a children's book entitled I Am Jazz. And so maybe, Dr. Laidlaw, you got jazzed yourself and you wrote an article for Public Discourse entitled Gender Dysphoria and Children, an Endocrinologist's Evaluation of I Am Jazz. And that seemed to like get you off the starting line, and you went on to publish in medical journals and speak and educate the public in California, in Washington, D.C., in the United Kingdom Parliament, and in front of the Florida Medical Board. And you've been providing expert testimony in states and, as I just mentioned, even for the Scarametti case. So I'm going to thank you. I know it's earlier in the day there in California where you live, but thanks for joining us on CMDA Matters today.
Certainly. Thanks so much for having me, guys. I appreciate it.
Well, why don't you tell us, let's get started by telling us, how did you get ramped up and so involved such that you're even an expert witness now at a national level?
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting story. It wasn't what I set out to do back in 2006, as you might imagine, going to my little private practice over here. But I started in 2017. I think I first heard about it on the radio or maybe some parents in the school district about this book called I Am Jazz being read in the schools. And there was quite a flurry and a going on with parents in particular about, you know, why was this being read to our kids without us knowing about it? And so for those who aren't familiar, and it was kind of a bigger thing back then, there's a what I'll call a natal male, person born as a male who goes by Jazz, whose parents had a Jazz as part of a TLC live kind of show where they record your day-to-day actions and showing Jazz's transition process, you know, from social transition. Jazz got onto puberty blockers to stop normal puberty. Jazz got onto hormones and was getting towards surgery. And so there's a book geared to children, which was read in the school system here. And I remember a parent telling me, you know, they had no idea this was going on. But their daughter had just gotten out of a bath, and, you know, she had long hair, but it was pressed up against her head. And she looked in the mirror and she goes, Mommy, it's happening. It's happening to me. And she's like, what's happening? I'm turning into a boy. Hmm. And you can imagine, you know, as a kid and you see that sort of thing, that external appearance, thinking, well, this my classmate's turning into a girl. So couldn't I be turning into a boy? And the mom was, you know, horrified by this and come to find out it was this book that was being read. And I kind of, because I was in the same school district, it wasn't at our particular school, but it was in the same school district. I got involved and she told me, actually, you know, you need to read this book. I just thought, well, this is some kind of little propaganda book, which it is. But I hadn't thought about it really from like a medical point of view, like some of the claims. So for example, one of the claims was that my name is Jazz, you know, I have a girl brain inside a boy body. You know, how is that possible that could happen, that you could develop male genitals, which we might get into some of the embryology, but then a female, you know, quote unquote female brain? That doesn't sound very scientific to me, and it isn't. Or another claim in there was that the doctor told Jazz that Jazz is transgender, which, you know, we all know, and maybe people don't know, that that's not a medical diagnosis. We have a medical diagnosis right now, gender dysphoria, meaning a discomfort between the way you feel your gender identity is and your physical body is. But someone can't say that, hey, you're a transgender. A doctor certainly can't say that. So anyways, it just started out kind of innocently writing a letter to the school board. And I went into great detail about hormones and surgeries and the fact that, you know, a lot of these kids have a high proportion have mental health issues. There's autism, there may be abuse and things like that, and that there's more to that the eye can see here. It's not simply you read a book. If you're going to talk to the kids about this book, then can you present the other side of this? What happens when you block normal puberty? What happens to the bones? What happens to the sexual organs? What happens with fertility? Are you going to go into detail, which I did at a school board meeting, about vaginoplasty? And I heard all the board members' jaws dropped when I said it. But part of my point was, you know, if you think this is appropriate, how about the other side? What about what I have to say? Are you going to present that to the kindergartners and first graders, second graders? This is much more complex than you understand. And this is much more affects your biology very, very deeply. So I helped with the school board there, but it was really Walt Heyer. You guys probably know Walt.
That. Yes.
Yeah. Walt's a great guy, and he lived as a female for a time and then back to a male for many years and back to a male. And he's written many books and he's helped so many people, so many detransitioners. But I had read his book because I wanted to know more about this. And I asked him, could you look at my letter to the school board? Because I want to be sensitive to the kids and to the parents who are going through this. I don't want to come across as, you know, overly harsh, but I want to give the truth about this. And so he passed it on to his publisher, which is Ryan Anderson. And anyways, that particular paper got published. And just from there, because there's so few people talking about it with any kind of expertise, one thing led to another and to those things that you mentioned, speaking in different areas and, you know, writing publications. Because what I found in at the school, trying to fight against the school system is kind of it was going nowhere in particular, because there's attorneys on the other side, ACLU and others, who are, in my opinion, kind of silencing school boards everywhere because they can't fight back because they don't have the expertise to fight back. And I really couldn't do much in the school system. So I said, well, then I need to move to the medical system and, you know, help with publications, and then got involved with people like Dr. Andre Van Malt and Dr. Laura Haynes and Michelle Cretella, Quentin Van Meter, Paul Cruz, a group of us, you know, all worked together. And then later Will Malone of Segem and different people. So I was expecting originally that we could, you know, like Paul Ruse is an endocrinologist, Quentin Van Meter, that we could get, it wouldn't be a matter of time, we get a bunch of endocrinologists and we tell the Endocrine Society what's going on and then this will all shut down. Naively, I thought that might happen in a year or two. And, you know, here we are several years later at the Supreme Court, still working on this.
Well, Dr. Laidlaw, before we get into some depth on the whole transgender issue, it might be helpful if you would give us maybe a 30,000-foot view of what we're looking at and how to approach the problem of gender dysphoria as well as gender affirmative therapy, or I call it gender transition therapy. What are your thoughts?
So if you sort of lay out what's happening, you have a person, I mean, we're talking about kids more so in these cases, but or an adult who has gender dysphoria, this mismatch between the way they feel inside as to what their sex is and their actual biological sex, and discomfort and distress that comes from that. And so when you talk about kids, there's different approaches. One would be just to allow for what I call natural desistance, or the fact that we know that most of these kids, as they grow up, go through puberty and enter adulthood, will leave this way of thinking or there's distress to a large degree and identify, you know, with the body they were born with. The other approach is, or another approach to this, is the gender affirmative therapy, which is really, I kind of break it down into four stages. One is a social transition, which is, you know, adopting mannerisms or clothes of styles of the opposite sex to try to appear like the opposite sex, which is a psychological intervention with its own set of harms. Then puberty blockers to stop normal puberty, then cross-sex hormones or opposite sex hormones to try to induce physical changes, like, for example, beard growth in a female-born person or breast development in a male-born person. And then finally, you know, surgeries of the type that may have to do with removing the genitals, vaginoplasty surgery to make a kind of a false vaginal cavity, or phalloplasty to generate a pseudo-phallus on a female-born person, or mastectomy, which is a common one. Even in teenagers. And the idea there is this, what they call appearance congruence, to sort of appear physically like the other sex. And the thing that because obviously I've thought about this for a number of years, there's different ways to approach, and not one's better than the other, but there's different ways you could look at why this is harmful or why this shouldn't occur. And I break it down into three categories. One is looking at the biological aspect or known biology of the human person. How does a person develop embryologically? How do their sex organs develop? What happens with their brain? What happens with their body through puberty? And what sort of harms develop when you interfere with those processes, which we can talk about. or physical harms of medications, hormones, for example, which are given in high doses, which I can describe. So one is a biological, physical aspect. A second way of looking at this is, what is the evidence base for these treatments? If there's a claim that this is going to help gender dysphoria, well, how many kids actually had their gender dysphoria reduced or gone away? Or how many actually had improvements in anxiety, depression, suicidal ideation, things like that? And that's where, you know, I think groups like SEGM are, that's where they're strongest, and that's where their interest is in looking at all of the different studies that have come out, which we know and we'll get into, are low quality, poor quality studies. And that's to a large degree, I think, also what the CAST review was looking at, and the York systematic reviews that it's based on. So that'd be the second kind of main group way to look at this. And the third, I would say, you know, kind of group together the ethical and legal aspects of this. Because it's one thing to say, even like, well, maybe there's a couple studies that show improvement in gender dysphoria. Okay, if that's the case, is it ethical to take an 11-year-old and put them on the path towards sterilization by starting them on puberty blockers when you know that's going to lead to hormones, when you know in many cases that's going to lead to sterilization based on the Dutch studies? Or do they have the capacity for informed consent? Can a parent provide informed consent for a child who's 11 who may not know what they want at age 25 or 30? So that's part of the ethical challenge of this, or ethical consideration of this. And then I kind of group together legal, you know, legal considerations, which are partly have to do with ethics, but partly have to do with what's happening now, like in the Tennessee case. Do states have a right, knowing what sort of harms can occur, knowing the poor evidence base, do they have a right to regulate what's going on in their state with respect to, in particular, kids, or maybe kids and adults, with regards to this medical treatment?
Before we continue with this week's episode, here's a special announcement for you. As a result of a partnership between CMDA and Alliance Defending Freedom, we are now offering free legal consultations for CMDA members who may be experiencing conscience freedom issues in the workplace. Exclusively available to CMDA members, this program is designed to serve members who feel they are being discriminated against in the workplace due to their firmly held moral and religious beliefs. If you feel your conscience freedoms are at risk, please visit cmda.org/legal to learn more about how we can help. Excited to announce the newest addition to CMDA's long list of resources for our members, and it is specifically for students and residents. Called Standing Strong in Training, this new curriculum helps healthcare students and residents stand up against the cultural pressures facing Christians within healthcare today. The curriculum's 7 modules are designed for group settings, allowing attendees to solidify their foundational worldview beliefs regarding important issues, such as the beginning of life, end of life, and biblical sexuality. Each module also offers ideas of how to winsomely defend biblical values and positively interact with others in developing their worldview beliefs. For more information and to download this free resource, visit cmda.org/standingstrong. Let's jump right back into this week's episode.
Michael, I want to ask you, it just seems that since this has come upon us so quickly, and I know there's a background that goes back to Dr. John Money at Johns Hopkins. I know there's a history here, but still, it seems that since the Obergefell Supreme Court case in 2015, it seems that so much has happened since that decision to allow same-sex marriage to happen in the United States, that the avalanche began. Well, how in the world did your specialty in particular, but also pediatrics, how was it so quickly overwhelmed with those who thought this was a really good thing? Because it's really, for so many, a head-scratcher. How did we get here? And even with those who come out of the Scrimeti case very positive in thinking about what this might mean for the state of Tennessee and other states, still, there is this bottom line reality. The house of medicine, almost every society except for what I understand the American Society of Plastic Surgeons, And that's because they're at the tip of the spear, I think. But they've all come out in support. And it's so difficult to push back long term when our medical associations seem just captive to this ideology. How did we so quickly, especially in endocrine medicine, pediatric medicine, how did we get here so quickly?
Now, that's a very good question. And like you said, Quentin Van Meter, he has a great, you know, long detailed history of what happened. But from my point of view, you know, I'm looking particularly at medical organizations. In 2009, the Endocrine Society first published its guidelines for, you know, people with gender incongruence. And they do talk about puberty blockers and hormones for kids and different things to do with adult transition. And if you look at it carefully, this is supported by another group called WPATH, whom you've heard of. This is the World Professional Association of Transgender Health. It used to be the Harry Benjamin Society or something like that. So they're an advocacy organization for people with this gender incongruence. And they've been around since, I think, the early 70s, and they've been publishing what they call standards of care or guidelines for a number of years. And if you look carefully, that this 2009 Endocrine Society guideline was supported by WPATH. And most of the, or majority of the authors were all WPATH members. And then this was, they did another, Endocrine Society had another one in 2017. And again, the majority of authors were from WPATH. So the way I see it, you know, the WPATH invaded or infiltrated, if you will, the Endocrine Society. I'm an Endocrine Society member. It's otherwise, you know, an excellent organization, you know, for all sorts of endocrine disease, diabetes, thyroid, adrenal, pituitary, you name it, with excellent researchers and so forth. But for whatever reason, I mean, obviously, because this has to do with hormones, they infiltrated, in my view, the Endocrine Society and got these guidelines published twice. And that's, to me, that's how I see they gained legitimacy, because a lot of documents will refer back to the Endocrine Society, you know, so if, and I'm not sure the AAP did specifically, but having some major hormonal organization advocate for you legitimize this. So that gives cover to all these other organizations.
Well, Dr. Chup and I have benefited from many of your articles and letters in numerous journals. And more recently, this past fall, you wrote a lengthy comment on an article in the Annals of Pharmacotherapy entitled "Exploring Safety in Gender-Affirming Hormonal Treatments, an Observational Study on Adverse Drug Events Using the Food and Drug Administration Adverse Event Reporting System Database." Now, I know that the vast majority of our members don't have the time to take a deep dive into some of the complications of these cross-sex hormones, but could you summarize for our members the most worrisome complications of cross-sex hormones in both natal males and females?
Yeah, I think I'll start with testosterone. And to give some perspective to the listeners, one of the things that struck me when I first started looking into this is how exceptionally high the doses are of testosterone that they're giving to natal females in order to raise testosterone levels and to make changes in their physical appearance, like beard growth and so forth. And so in endocrinology, there's common disorders which lead to elevated testosterone levels, which can present metabolic problems, cardiovascular risk to patients, like polycystic ovarian syndrome, for example, is one of them. And these patients have, with say polycystic ovarian syndrome, if the normal level of testosterone for a female is 10 to 50, say a level of 100, it would be considered high and could lead to different metabolic changes. Well, what they're advocating with the Endocrine Society WPATH is to raise levels up to 300 to 1,000, which is, if you do some calculations, about 6 to 100 times higher than normal circulating female testosterone levels. And so that can lead to all sorts of harms, as you might imagine. I mean, generally in endocrinology, this only happens with like endocrine tumors or you know, adrenal carcinoma, something like that, which is rare. So for females, there are physical changes which can happen. There's a risk for increased risk of myocardial infarction and death due to cardiovascular disease, shown by a Dr. Erwig. Erythrocytosis, or high red blood cell levels, which look to be independently associated with cardiovascular risk. High blood pressure, increased risk of breast cancer, uterine, ovarian cancer potential. Of course, you have hirsutism, which is abnormal growth of hair on the face, chest, so forth, which if a person regrets having this treatment later, has to be treated by, you know, permanent means to remove these. A deepening of the voice, which again, at one time may be thought to be beneficial to the person, but if they regret, this is not reversible. And then, of course, you have changes to the genitourinary system. You know, it looks like atrophy of the vagina, changes to the ovaries, like polycystic, like ovarian changes, atrophy of the uterus. Or I've seen some of the pathology studies with proliferative type changes, even changes I've seen where there's prostate-like cells developing in the cervix or vagina from this. And so those are physical effects. And what we concentrate, and just to back up a little bit, this paper, which I found very interesting, because I had been saying for some time that another thing about these high levels of testosterone is that they're similar to anabolic steroid abuse, where you're doing many, many times higher the levels of steroids like testosterone in order to make physical changes in the body, which we tend to think of men abusing these sort of hormones, but it can happen with females also. And what they've found when they've looked at in terms of psychological changes that can happen with anabolic steroid abuse, you're talking about irritability, aggressiveness, hyperactivity, reckless or dangerous behavior. They had found that 23% of subjects using these steroids had met criteria for major mood syndrome. And even somewhere around 10% had psychotic symptoms. And I had been writing about this in different places, but when I saw this particular study and my co-author, Sarah Jorgensen, and I, and she's a pharmacologist, looked at this together, we said, you know, there's so many similar findings here from this adverse reaction database in the United States for people who had some kind of gender identity condition and were taking testosterone, that they had many of those similar psychiatric effects were happening to them. And it just confirmed, you know, what I thought, that the dangers, not only physically, but at a psychiatric level with testosterone in particular. So that's testosterone. If we look at estrogen, for estrogen given to males, same thing, looks to be increased risk of myocardial infarction, death due to cardiovascular disease, shown by Dr. Erwig. I think a big risk, which we physicians know with estrogen in particular, could be thromboembolic risk, blood clots, deep vein thrombosis, pulmonary embolism. The risk is 5 times increased, what they've shown for males taking estrogen, which again are high doses of estrogen relative to the male body. I did a calculation somewhere, I can't remember offhand, but like 3 to 48 times higher than normal circulating male estradiol levels. Also risk for gallstones, high triglycerides, breast cancer, which we know is not very common in males. I think something like 3% of all cases was shown to be increased 46 times in males receiving estrogen, which I guess not surprising. Mm-hmm. Of course, gynecomastia, which is, we consider it to be an abnormal, you know, breast growth condition in males, is part of what they're trying to achieve. But again, for people who regret this condition later, if they want to remove breasts later, involves a pretty difficult, or in other words, painful type surgery and recovery, and it's very expensive and it may not be covered by insurance. And so I know a detransitioner who personally is dealing with that problem. And then you have the issue, again, in both sexes, of sexual dysfunction, potential for infertility, but particularly if kids are started on puberty blockers at an early pubertal stage, beginnings of puberty, before they develop sperm or have ovulation or menstruation, then the risk for, well, they'll be infertile, and permanent sterility is a possibility from these hormones. And of course, surgeries that remove gonads will make that happen.
As I mentioned earlier, this is only part one of our conversation. So be sure to come back next week to hear what Dr. Michael Laidlaw and a number of concerned colleagues of his, some of whom he mentioned today, have learned and shared in the public square over the last 7 or 8 years. Did you hear what Michael shared early on in our conversation? He said, quote, "I hadn't thought about it, this whole idea of gender transition, from a medical point of view." What a wake-up moment for this endocrinologist, which he said in almost an offhanded sort of way at the beginning of our conversation. I wonder, friends, how many of us would have said that exact same thing when we first started hearing about the rise of transgenderism about a decade ago. Quote, "I hadn't really thought about it from a medical point of view." This conversation with Dr. Michael is important not just for us as healthcare professionals, but it's also critical for all parents to be listening and thinking about this topic from a medical point of view, minus the ideology, from a parental point of view, from a societal point of view. Would you share this episode with your colleagues and friends who could benefit from hearing about how transgenderism, it continues to impact and infiltrate our culture and our schools, and how we can follow his, Michael's footsteps and get involved? Friends, it is the house of medicine. The house of medicine that is in disarray here, and no matter how many laws are passed or court cases that are won, it is our precious and privileged profession that has been duped, as well as damaged in this gender dysphoria detour. Until our house, until healthcare professionals at large wake up and see the egregious harm to children and adolescents and return to our Hippocratic roots, including primum non nocere, do no harm, then this transgender revolution is not going anywhere. If you want to delve more into the topics that we were discussing in this episode, then I do want to encourage you to check out CMDA's The Point blog. It's a weekly blog in which we share the latest perspectives and opinions on today's important healthcare topics. Our various expert authors, they dive deeper into topics like the CAS review that we discussed today, the false science behind this movement, and much more. You'll find that blog by going to cmda.org/thepoint. And if you want to follow in Michael's bold and courageous footsteps and engage with this issue in your state's legislature, or to help testify in support of bills to protect minors from this dangerous ideology, then I hope, friends, you will take the time to connect with CMDA's advocacy and communications team. It's the beginning of a new legislative season right now in 2025, so it's the right time to get involved. You can contact advocacy@cmda.org for more information about what's happening in your state. Well, I told you I'd give an announcement about our year-end giving, and I wanted you to know that on December 31st, we wrapped up our year-end giving campaign. And today, I want to extend our heartfelt gratitude from CMDA National Ministry to each and every one of you who contributed so generously toward our $1 million goal. With all of the gifts postmarked December 31st now accounted for, I'm blessed to share that CMDA received $949,000 toward this goal. Of course, we didn't quite reach that goal of $1 million, but raising $949,000 is a significant achievement, and it's a testament to the dedication of this wonderful community of Christian healthcare professionals. Your unwavering support and belief in the mission and ministries of CMDA, well, they're truly inspiring to this chief encouragement officer. Thank you once again for your commitment. Together, we continue to see the lives of so many transformed through the power of the gospel, which is at the core of the mission and ministries of CMDA. In case you missed my announcement last week, I also wanted to remind you that the CMDA coaching team has an upcoming series of exciting events in the next few months. The first is a free, informal session in just a couple of days on January 19th at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, titled, What Am I Doing? And Other Important Questions to Ask Myself. The second is for those who are interested in learning how to coach and to enhance your leadership skills. It's the 501 Foundations for Coaching course. There are actually two options, including a six-week course that runs January 28th through March 4th, or a two-day course that is going April 4th and 5th. And the last course, a different one, one that I actually have signed up for, is called Mentoring with a Coach Approach. That course starts February 6th. It's a four-week class that meets each Tuesday evening and will teach us how to mentor with a coaching mindset, empowering us with coaching techniques for effective mentoring. Limited spots are available. I took one of them, so visit cmda.org/coaching for more information and to register. Next week, please join me right back here as we continue our conversation with Dr. Michael Laidlaw. I want to end this week's episode with a comment that I've actually shared on the podcast before. It's a great reminder for me, and I hope it is encouraging to you as well. A CMDA member from Texas said, quote, "It is so good to have people who believe the same and who recognize that this transgender movement is not grounded in medicine." We know the truth behind this statement, friends, and our conversation with Dr. Michael Laidlaw, it even more strongly reminds us that the transgender movement is not grounded in medicine. My prayer today, CMDA, is that you will be educated, encouraged, and equipped to speak out against this movement, which is not grounded in medical science and which is putting our patients, and especially our children and our adolescents, at risk. And as you do so, you will be educated, you'll be encouraged, and you'll be equipped to bring the hope and healing of Christ to them and to the world. That's what matters to CMDA. And CMDA matters in 2025. We'll see you next week for part two with Dr. Michael Laidlaw, God willing.
Thanks for listening to CMDA Matters. If you would like to suggest a future guest or share a comment with us, please email cmdamatters@cmda.org. And if you like the podcast, be sure to give us a 5-star rating and share it on your favorite social media platform. This podcast has been a production of Christian Medical and Dental Associations. The opinions expressed by guests on this podcast are not necessarily endorsed by Christian Medical and Dental Associations. CMDA is a nonpartisan organization that does not endorse political parties or candidates for public office. The views expressed on this podcast reflect judgments regarding principles and values held by CMDA and its members, and are not intended to imply endorsement of any political party or candidate.